Lynn asked. He more than has it coming.
Possibly, Bridget allowed. But to humiliate him would be to invite some other kind of indirect reprisal. If not upon me, then upon my father. My father is a good man. I won't see that kind of mischief brought to him because of me.
She looked at Benedict.
Is there some weapon that we could use that would allow him to win without slaughtering me or looking like a fool?
There's no weapon, tool, or clockwork in the world that could make Reggie not look the fool, Gwen said in an acid tone.
I don't care about victory, Bridget said. I don't care about making him look bad. I just want to move on with my life as if we'd never traded words.
You're right, cuz, Benedict said, nodding slowly. She has a wretched attitude about dueling for pride. The two traded another longer look, which again made Bridget feel that she'd skipped the necessary background reading needed to understand.
Food?
Gwendolyn suggested suddenly.
The two of you came out here so early. You've missed breakfast call. Inquisition class is in half an hour, and you don't want to run on an empty stomach after that.
She looked up at Raoul and added,
And for you as well, Master Cat. I'm buying.
Raoul said smugly,
This one has her priorities well sorted. Tell her my favorite food.
Raoul, Bridget said, That is not how one goes about such things.
She looked up to find both of the Lancasters staring at her.
You speak cat,
Benedict said. I mean, I'd heard that some people claimed to do it, but for goodness sake, you sounded exactly like a cat just now.
He has no idea how terrible your accent is,
Raoul observed.
Bridget rolled her eyes at the cat and said to Benedict, Yes, of course. Do you not have any cats in residence at House Lancaster?
Certainly not, Gwendolyn said.
Mother wouldn't hear of it.
We do, actually, Benedict said, cutting over Gwendolyn smoothly. The servants have an arrangement with several cats to handle vermin, but as far as I knew, it's an old understanding, and no one there has ever actually communicated directly with a cat before.
Gwendolyn blinked several times. How is it that you know that when I do not?
Because no one tells you anything, cuz, Benedict said. Perhaps because you spend so much time with Lady Lancaster, and often do not pause to think before you speak.
Gwendolyn tilted her head to one side as if to acknowledge a fair point. Then she blinked again and said, And then I'm afraid that I have been quite rude. I have neither introduced myself to your companion, nor sought introduction to him. Please convey to him my apologies, if you would, Miss Targon.
Bridget looked carefully at Gwendolyn for a moment, waiting for the flash of mockery that would appear in her eyes, as they would have in Reggie's. But it didn't come. She seemed sincere, imperious and obsessed with protocol, but sincere.
What is this, she asks, little mouse?
Raoul said, leaning forward to peer intently at Gwendolyn.
She seeks an exchange of names, Bridget told him, in cat. Human names, not cat names. She feels she has wronged you by not seeking it sooner.
Raoul stiffened in indignation.
Has she?
Perhaps not intentionally, Bridget allowed. She wasn't sure what to think of a cat appearing among humans. I suspect she genuinely seeks to avoid giving offense.
Raoul's tail lashed back and forth.
What would Wordkeeper say of her?
Bridget smiled slightly. She knew precisely how her father would treat Miss Lancaster.
He would ask her to tea and extend all courtesy.
Raoul nodded his head sharply, once, a very human gesture.
Then I will also extend courtesy. Tell her my name, and that she has not yet earned a cat name of her own, but that breakfast is a good start.
Bridget turned to Gwendolyn and said,
Miss Lancaster, this is Raoul of the Silent Paws tribe, Kit to Maul, chief of the Silent Paws.
A prince of his house, as you are of yours, coz, Benedict noted. Gwendolyn evidently had the grace to avoid looking skeptical at this pronouncement. She gave Benedict a decidedly unreadable look, which only made him smile. He had, Bridget thought, a very nice smile. Gwendolyn turned back to look at Raoul seriously and said, "Welcome, Sir Raoul, to the human part of Habble Morning. It would please me very much to buy you breakfast, if you would permit it." Raoul promptly plopped down into Bridget's arms, his throaty purr needing no translation.
"A very good start," he murmured.
"Yes, Miss Lancaster," Bridget said. "That would be fine."
Chapter 6 Spire Albion, Habble Morning. Raoul watched Little Mouse and her fellow humans behaving foolishly and wondered how soon she would need him to intervene and set things right. Once more they had slept less than all the humans in the Spire Ark's guard, and once more the human, Gwendolyn, and her half-souled cousin thought that they were preparing Little Mouse for some kind of combat, which was ridiculous. The best way to prepare for fighting was to fight. Any kitten knew that. Currently Benedict was having Little Mouse practice falling, which was similarly ridiculous. One didn't practice falling. One simply landed on one's feet. Yet over and over, Little Mouse fell from her feet to her back. Sometimes alone, sometimes helped along the way by Gwendolyn or Benedict. Raoul had been suspicious of this activity at first, assuming that it would be used as an excuse for Gwendolyn to eliminate a rival female, or for Benedict to claim mating rights with Little Mouse. But over the past few days it had proven to be more foolish than nefarious, and did not seem to harm Little Mouse to any significant degree, so Raoul permitted it to continue. It seemed a shame to waste so much of one's time, and to miss so much sleep, in such a fundamentally stupid activity. If they'd only asked Raoul about it, he could have explained it to them. Benedict began to show Little Mouse how to make him fall to the floor. What was the point of learning to do such a thing slowly, and obviously with considerable cooperation from Benedict? Did Little Mouse think that a foe would behave in such a way? Raoul sensed a pressure change in the air against the fur of his flank and his whiskers, and lazily tilted an ear in that direction. There was a whisper of motion, utterly inaudible to anyone but a cat, with all the commotion the humans were making to cover it, and Meryl emerged from the shadows.
"Raoul,"
said the black-furred female. Meryl was a small cat, but swift and intelligent. She was one of Maul's whiskers, his spies and hunters. Only a tiny ring of green was visible around her large, dark pupils, and the only way to see her in the gloom was by the dim shine of her eyes.
"Meryl,"
Raoul replied lazily. Meryl prowled to his side and sat studying the humans.
"What are they doing?" "They mean to teach Little Mouse to fight," Raoul said.
Meryl considered them gravely.
"I see. Have they begun yet?"
"They seem to think so," Raoul said.
"What news from my father?"
"He sends his greetings and says that you are to do your duty, or he will notch your ears."
Raoul flicked his tail and yawned.
"I know what I am to do. Is that all?"
Meryl twitched her ears in an amused flick, but her tone became more serious.
"He says that Long Thinker has confirmed the reports of the Silent Paw Scouts."
Raoul moved his eyes to the smaller cat.
"The new things in the air shafts?"
Meryl blinked her eyes in affirmation.
"So say the Shadow Tales, and the Quick Claws, and half a dozen other tribes besides them. Cats have gone missing in other habbles as well, but none have seen what took them."
Raoul made an irritated sound in his chest.
That seems cowardly.
"To me," Myril said, "it seems skillful."
"That is well. Are we then at war?"
"Not yet," Myril said. "Maul says that first we must know whom we would war against."
"What does Longthinker say we face?"
"Longthinker is not sure."
Raoul looked at Myril sharply, but he said nothing. His tail lashed back and forth restlessly. Longthinker was not Cat, but he was clever, wise, and honorable. If he did not know what threat now stalked the Silent Paws and other tribes in their own home tunnels, it must be something strange indeed, or something new.
"Please tell my father," Raoul said, "that I advise a declaration of war, immediately, without restriction. We will be better served by immediate aggression than by too much caution. Let us hunt and destroy them before they have a chance to nest."
"I will tell him your words," Myril said.
She twitched a careless whisker.
"He will not heed them."
Raoul ignored that last remark with the disdain it richly deserved. Myril sat beside him and watched the humans flopping about.
"I have seen such a thing before."
"This fight teaching?"
Raoul asked, his tone dubious.
"In the Temple of the Way, in Habel Landing," Myril said.
"What were you doing all the way down there?"
Raoul asked.
"My duty as a whisker,"
Myril replied loftily.
"They did something resembling this, only there were more of them, and they wore different kinds of clothing."
"Did they look this foolish?"
Myril tilted her head thoughtfully.
"Many did, but others seemed less foolish."
"In what way?"
"They moved less poorly."
"Not so well as a cat, of course."
"Of course,"
Raoul said.
"But they were much less clumsy than most humans."
She used a paw to comb the fur of one ear.
"Perhaps it works."
They both watched Little Mouse take a particularly hard fall.
"Eventually."
"They are rather slow, humans,"
Raoul mused.
"Do you really think it has potential?"
"She hardly need be much less clumsy to make another human look so,"
Myril said.
"Whom is she to fight?"
"A young male." He aimed words of pain at Wordkeeper. In reply, Little Mouse slapped his ears with her words. Now they plan to fight.
"They plan to fight?"
Myril said, mystified.
"Why does she not go find him in his sleep and fight him then?"
Raoul yawned.
"I have no idea." "But he will not find her in her sleep. If he tries, I will rip out his eyes."
"Sensible,"
Myril said.
"Though a human is no easy prey, not even for the mighty Raoul."
"A proper whisker should not make so much noise,"
Raoul growled. Myril rose and bowed her head in a mirror of the human gesture.
"Yes, mighty Raoul."
Raoul fetched her a swift rap on the nose, though not with his claws extended, but Myril avoided it with lazy grace, her eyes dancing with laughter. She sauntered off, flicking her tail mockingly.
"You are almost as handsome as you think you are, you know."
and you are too quick and too clever for your own good.
Raoul replied calmly,
Keep your wits about you in the tunnels.
I would prefer it if you did not go missing.
Don't make a foolish mistake that gets you killed while protecting your human, she replied.
Will I see you again soon?
Perhaps, Myrl said.
It depends on my mood.
Then she glided back into the dark the way she had come. Raoul watched her go, the insufferable female. He stared after her for a moment, his tail lashing thoughtfully.
Insubordinate, but quick, and beautiful, and never, ever boring.
Perhaps he would compose a song for her.
Once fighting practice was over, things that mattered could be done.
Raoul took his customary place in Little Mouse's arms and accompanied her to breakfast in the marketplace. The marketplace was a sea of stalls and small buildings set in the centre of the Habble, surrounding the Spire Lord's manor. About a quarter of the stalls were made of spire stone, originally placed there by someone the humans called the Builders. The remainder were made mostly of brick, their doors and vending windows now covered with hide stretched over frames. Some of the more well-to-do shops used wood from the jungle-covered surface, painstakingly transported up miles of spire. Little Mouse carried him toward the stall that smelled the best and was one of the few that were occupied this early in the day. Human Benedict seemed to know the owners of the stall personally, for they greeted him by name each morning. It was probably due to his hunger. The half-soul's body burned hotter than other humans, almost exactly as hot as a cat's, and he had to eat more frequently than other humans. Raoul waited while Benedict ordered for everyone and paid with the small pieces of metal the humans valued so dearly. Once that was done, the food was made, and the humans went to a nearby table to eat. Raoul took his seat beside Little Mouse, who placed a roll of bread and meat in front of him. Raoul tore it open with his claws and waited for the little gouts of steam to clear. It did not matter how delicious the food tasted. Burning one's tongue was an undignified experience, and he did not intend to repeat it.
"What do you think of the training, Raoul?" Benedict asked politely, after the human had wolfed down one of the rolls whole.
Raoul eyed Little Mouse. In his judgment, she did not seem to have made up her mind whether or not to favor these two humans with her loyalty, but she clearly regarded Human Benedict as a potential mate. It would be discourteous of him to jeopardize her chances of propagating her species.
"It seems painful,"
he said to Little Mouse. She translated this into the human tongue, smiling wryly.
"It can be," Benedict said, "but in an actual fight, you might be injured and need to function anyway. Little pains now could save a life later."
"Cutting Reggie's throat in his sleep could do so as well,"
Raoul said, and eyed Little Mouse. She rolled her eyes, translating that, and Human Gwendolyn promptly began choking on some of her food. Raoul calmly took a few bites from the cooler edges of his dumpling.
"Quite a direct soul, isn't he?"
Gwendolyn managed after a few moments.
"You have no idea," Little Mouse said.
"There is a good reason to limit the conflict to something less decisive," Benedict said, addressing Raoul directly. "Reggie is a member of a large and powerful family. The man who will be his second is also an Aster of a cadet branch of the house. If anything permanent happens to Reggie, the second will report it, and they might seek vengeance."
"I would think they would be glad to rid themselves of a fool,"
Raoul replied. Human Gwendolyn made a snorting sound when Little Mouse translated, and took another bite of her breakfast.
"To a degree," Benedict allowed.
"But if they tolerate harm to a member of their house, others might see it as a sign of weakness."
"Ah,"
Raoul said.
That makes at least a little sense.
He considered the situation gravely.
But Little Mouse does not have a large house to take vengeance on her behalf, should Reggie do something permanent to her.
Benedict seemed uncomfortable when Little Mouse translated that.
There is a certain amount of truth in that.
But it is not in the interests of anyone in the Habble for duels to be lethal. Pressure could be brought against House Aster if such actions were taken.
If he kills Little Mouse?
Raoul asked.
Would the House of Lancaster then war upon the House of Aster?
Benedict and Gwendolen exchanged a long look.
I don't think so.
Then this pressure you speak of is a paw without claws,
Raoul said.
It will do nothing to truly prevent his action.
Gwendolen abruptly leaned across the table, looked hard at Raoul, and said firmly, If any such thing happens to Miss Tarquin, Master Raoul, I will personally challenge Reggie with gauntlets and blow a hole in him large enough for a cat to leap through. You have my word on that.
Not only have I already lost the duel, Little Mouse murmured, but I've been killed as well. Why are we wasting breakfast on a dead woman?
Raoul looked up at Little Mouse and said, not unkindly,
You were already fool enough to become involved in this. It is time to let wiser heads than yours sort it out. I promise that once I am sure that you are not blindly walking into your own death, I will let you lose the fight on your own.
Little Mouse scowled at Raoul.
What did he say?
Benedict asked, blinking back and forth between them.
That he wants a bath,
Little Mouse said, in a decidedly threatening tone.
Really, Little Mouse?
Raoul said, nibbling another bite.
You must at some point begin to grow out of these childish outbursts.
Oh!
Little Mouse said, her face flushing.
You can be so infuriating.
You're only angry because you know I'm right,
Raoul said, in the tone one ought to use when one knows one is obviously correct and the other is entirely wrong. Footsteps approached through the gloom, and Raoul looked over to see the human Reggie's associate approaching the breakfast table. He watched without moving, but settled his feet into a good place to allow him to throw himself at the enemy's eyes should he attempt anything harmful. A few seconds later, Raoul's humans became aware of the human approaching. He came to a stop at their table and lifted his chin.
Benedict? Gwen? Miss Targwin?
Raoul narrowed his eyes.
Good morning, Barnabas.
Human Gwendolen said in a chill tone.
You're going to support him, are you?
The human Barnabas shrugged, apparently unfazed.
The challenge was formally given and accepted, Gwen. He means to see it through.
That doesn't mean that you have to be the one who seconds him,
she replied.
He's blood,
Barnabas said simply.
Besides, if I don't, some hothead will.
Benedict shook his head.
He's got a point, Gwen.
I'm sorry you got dragged into this, Barney. Barnabas shrugged.
Miss Tarquin, may I ask who's serving as your second?
Me,
said humans, Benedict and Gwendolen at the same time. And even as they did, Raoul let out his most violent and raucous war cry and hurtled at human Barnabas's eyes. The human was taken utterly off guard. He flung up his arms and fell backward. Raoul landed with his weight on the human's chest and rode him all the way to the spirestone floor. The human fell even more clumsily than Little Mouse did, and hit with a huff of expelled breath, briefly stunned. Everyone there, in fact, looked briefly stunned. Raoul sat calmly on his chest, leaned over close to human Barnabas's face, and snarled.
I am Raoul, Kit of Maul, Lord and Master of the Silent Paws, and I am her second.
Little Mouse translated this in a startled, jerky voice. Human Barnabas stared at Raoul with wide eyes, and then looked back and forth between him and Little Mouse, listening.
You can't be serious,
Barnabas sputtered in response. Raoul batted him sharply on the nose with enough claw to draw a few drops of educational blood and let out another growl.
Pay attention, human. Little Mouse will meet the Reggie in unarmed battle in the market, in the light of noon, 7 days hence.
Barnabas stared some more, eyeing the cat and then Little Mouse's translation. Benedict, he said a moment later. Reggie picked an idiotic moment to indulge his taste for duels, but this is beyond the pale. A cat, as her second. What will people think? Benedict pursed his lips thoughtfully.
If it were me, I'd probably think that Reggie was one of the scum of the great houses, throwing his weight around against someone like Miss Targwin.
But I think you're missing the point here, Barney.
And what point would that be? He demanded.
Him,
Benedict said, and pointed at Raoul. Raoul lashed his tail, never looking away from Human Barnabas's eyes. He held them for a moment, then rose and calmly prowled back to his breakfast. Little Mouse asked, in cat,
This is what Maul wants.
Obviously,
Raoul said. He might have sounded smug. Not that he didn't deserve to feel that way, of course. The human Barnabas had been entirely at his mercy.
I'm sure I don't understand, Barnabas said, staring at the cat.
I'm sure you don't either, sir, Little Mouse said. But you will, in 1 week.
Chapter 7 Spire Albion, Havel Morning, Ventilation Tunnels. Grimm strode toward the Spire Arc's manor, his booted steps striking the stone floor with sharp, clear impacts, and reminded himself that murdering the idiot beside him in an abrupt surge of joyous violence would be in extremely bad taste.
"Perhaps her time has come," said Commodore Hamilton Rook. He was a tall, regal-looking man, provided one desired a monarch whose nose was shaped like a sunhawk's beak. His black hair was untouched by silver, which Grimm was certain was an affectation. His face and hands were weathered and cracked from his time aboard his ship, a battlecruiser called Glorious, a peer of Itasca, if not even remotely her rival. He was refined, well-educated, exquisitely polite, and an utter ass. His fleet uniform was a proper deep blue, accented with an unseemly amount of gold braid and filigree, and bore three gold bands at the end of each sleeve.
What say you, my good Francis?
Grimm glanced aside and up at Rook.
As ever, I ask you not to call me Francis.
Ah, the middle name then, I suppose. Madison?
Grimm felt the fingers of his sword hand tighten and relax.
Commodore, you are well aware that I prefer Grimm.
A tad stuffy, Rook said disapprovingly. Might as well call you Captain all day. As though you still had a true commission.
Extremely bad taste, Grimm thought. Appallingly bad taste. Historically bad taste. No matter how joyous.
I had hoped your recent successes might have made you less insecure,
Rook continued.
And you haven't answered my question. My offer is more than generous.
Grimm turned down a side corridor, out of the main traffic of the day in Havel Morning.
Your offer to pay me a quarter of her worth to break my ship into scrap.
I had assumed you were making some kind of stillborn attempt at humor.
Come now. Don't romanticize this, Rook said. She's been a fine vessel, but Predator is outdated as a warship and undersized as a ship of trade. For what I'm offering you, you could secure a merchant vessel that would make you several fortunes. Think of your posterity.
Grimm smiled faintly.
and the fact that you would secure her core crystal for your house's inventory is beside the point, I suppose.
Crystals, of suitable size and density to serve as a ship's power core, were grown over the course of decades and centuries. Core crystals were not expensive. They were priceless. In Spire Albion, all current crystal production was under commission to the fleet, leaving a set number of core crystals available to private owners, most of whom would not part with them at any price. Over the past two centuries, the great houses had been steadily acquiring the remaining core crystals. Certainly they could be had from other spires, but so far as Grimm knew, no one in the world could match in power or quality the crystals the Lancasters produced.
"Of course it would do no small amount of good for the standing of our house," Rook replied. "But it's an honest offer, nonetheless."
"No," Grimm said.
"Very well," Rook said, his voice tightening. "I'll double it."
"No, twice."
The larger man took a step in front of Grimm and stopped, glaring.
"See here, Francis. I mean to have that crystal. I've seen the damage report your engineer turned in. You were lucky to make it back to the spire at all."
"Was I?"
"You need entirely new power runs, a new main lift crystal, and at least three new trim crystals. I've seen your accounts. You've nowhere near enough money to afford them."
"She's wounded," Grimm said firmly, "not a derelict."
"Wounded," Rook said, rolling his eyes. "She can barely limp up and down the side of the spire on a tether. Predator isn't an airship any longer. She's barely a windlass."
Grimm suddenly found himself facing Rook, his hands clenched into fists. Rook apparently did not notice that detail.
"I am making you an open and friendly offer, Francis. Don't force me to resort to other means."
Grimm stood silently for a moment, staring up at Hamilton Rook's sneer.
"And what means, sir," he asked quietly, "would those be?"
"I can pursue it in the courts, if need be," he said. "Report on the dangerously slipshod handling of your ship. Report on the number of casualties you've suffered. Report on the complaints and accusations of criminal behaviour other spires have forwarded to the fleet."
Grimm ground his teeth.
"I incurred those accusations while acting on the fleet's behalf, and you know it."
"And would be ordered to deny it," Rook said, his smile widening.
"Honestly, Francis, do you really think the fleet would rather stand by you, a disgraced outcast, than suffer a public humiliation like that?" The smile vanished.
"I will have that core crystal, Grimm."
Grimm nodded thoughtfully. And then, quite quickly, and with no restraining gentleness whatsoever, he slapped Commodore Hamilton Rook across the face. The smack of the impact echoed down the empty corridor. Rook reeled back, stunned by the fact of the blow more than the force of it, and stared at Grimm with wide eyes.
"Predator is not property," Grimm said in a calm, level tone. "She is not my possession. She is my home. Her crew are not my employees. They are my family. And if you threaten to take my home and destroy the livelihood of my family again, Commodore, I will be inclined to kill you where you stand."
Rook's eyes blazed, and he drew himself up to his full, intimidating height.
"You arrogant insect," he snarled. "Do you think you can slap me about without paying for it?"
In answer, Grimm took a quick step forward and did it again. Rook tried to flinch away from the blow, but Grimm's hand was too quick for him. Again, the sound of the slap echoed down the hallway.
"I'll do it any damned time I please, sir," Grimm said in the same level voice. "Take me to court. Let me tell the judges and the public record precisely what incensed me enough to strike you. You will be publicly humiliated. If you hoped to keep any shred of your reputation, you would have no choice except to challenge me to a duel. And, as the challenged party, I would insist upon the protocol mortis.
Rook leaned his head back slightly from Grimm, as though he had opened his pantry to fetch cheese and found a Crawley scale waiting for him instead.
You wouldn't dare. Even if you won, my family would have your hide.
I'd change my flag to Spire Olympia, Grimm said. They'd be glad to have me. Let the rooks attempt their little game with the captain of an Olympian vessel.
Do you think your corpse is worth that, Hamilton?
Rook clenched his fists at his sides. That's treason!
For an officer of the fleet, yes, Grimm said, baring his teeth.
But not for a disgraced outcast like me.
You wretched little nothing, Rook said. I should...
Grimm took a step forward, never breaking eye contact, forcing Rook to take a step back.
You should what, Commodore? He said. Say nasty things behind my back. Challenge me to a duel.
You haven't got the spine to look in a man's eyes when you kill him.
That's something else we both know.
Rook clenched his teeth, seething.
I will not forget this, Grimm.
Grimm nodded.
Yes. One of your many excellent failings, Hamilton, is that you forget favors and remember insults.
Indeed. My house has a long memory and wide vision.
Grimm felt a surge of anger threaten to shatter his demeanor, but he suppressed it from everything but the tenor of his voice.
Wide vision. Is that how you style it? Know this. If anything happens to any of my men, or to any of their families, anything, no matter how small, I shall hold you personally responsible. I shall denounce you to the Admiralty and the Council within the hour, and in the duel that follows, I shall kill you and cast your body from the top of the spire,
and not necessarily in that order. Am I perfectly clear, Commodore?
Rook swallowed and took another half step back. Grimm pointed a finger at him and said,
Stay away from my home. Stay away from my family.
Good day, sir.
Then the captain of Predator turned precisely on a heel and continued marching toward the palace. Grimm hadn't been walking for 2 minutes when a calm, amused voice spoke from the darkness of an unlit side corridor.
What's happened to you, Mad?
You've acquired a few shreds of discretion. I remember a time when you would have braced that pompous twit in the middle of the Habel market at noonday.
Grimm snorted and didn't slow his steps.
I've no time to fence with you, Bayard.
A small, slender figure of a man appeared from the gloom and fell into step beside him. Alexander Bayard wore a Commodore's uniform, almost precisely like Rook's, if not quite as richly fashioned. It was also a great deal more weather-worn. Bayard loved to spend his days aboard ship, out on the deck of his flag vessel, the heavy cruiser Valiant, whereas Rook hid from the elements whenever he could.
Yes,
Bayard said easily. The smaller man lengthened his strides to match Grimm's.
I've heard. You've a ship that can barely stay afloat, and no means to repair her. So I'm certain you're in quite the rush to clear port again.
Don't make me duel you, Grimm said.
Why on earth not?
Bayard said, putting a bit of extra swagger in his step. He had dark, glittering eyes and hair that had gone magnificently silver decades before its time.
You'd lose, and we both know it.
Grimm snorted.
You're a true tradesman of violence, my stiff-necked friend,
Bayard continued.
But you've no ice in your soul, and not a speck of reptile in your blood. It takes calculation to win a duel against a reptile, and you've always been impatient.
Grimm found himself smiling.
You've just called yourself a reptile, Commodore.
And so I am, Bayard agreed. I'm a viper who plays every angle to his advantage.
His smile faded slightly.
Which is why I'm in uniform and you aren't, I'm afraid.
There was no point in both of us being drummed out, Grimm replied. You know that I don't hold it against you, Alex.
You needn't. I'll do it for you. And as for Rook...
Bayard shuddered.
If it comes to a duel, I hope you will call upon me to be your second.
I find it unlikely that I should be so desperate, Grimm said. I suppose that if everyone else says no, I may consider you.
Excellent. A day in advance, at least, if you please. My mistress would never understand if I walked out on her abruptly.
Grimm barked out a laugh. Neither of you is married, and you've been seeing each other exclusively for 11 years now?
13,
Bayard said smugly.
God in heaven, and yet you persist in the fiction that she is your mistress even now. Why?
A boyish grin spread over Bayard's face.
Because scandal, old friend, is ever so much more enjoyable than propriety. Such things are the spice of life.
You are a degenerate, Grimm said, but he was smiling widely now, and the rage and frustration he'd felt at his encounter with Rook had faded away. How is Abigail?
Rosy-cheeked, starry-eyed, and content, my friend. She sends her love.
Please convey my warmest respects, Grimm said. He cocked his head to one side and regarded Bayard. Thank you, Alex.
Rook would try the patience of an archangel, Bayard said, inclining his head. You are not without friends, Grimm. Don't waste another moment in concern for the fool.
I would not consider the time spent thrashing him wasted. Bayard let out a rich, warm laugh.
Few would, I dare say.
They came to a dim section of largely unused tunnel, where the lumen crystals were spaced widely apart. Grimm put his hand lightly upon the tunnel wall to guide his nearly blind steps. You didn't just happen upon me when I needed a boost in morale. You were following me.
Obviously.
Why?
I think you need to speak to the Spyrarch.
That's where I'm going now, Grimm said.
Ah, yes, Bayard replied. But you see, he is not in his manor. He sent me to bring you to him.
Bayard stopped abruptly in his tracks. Grimm followed suit almost instantly. The tunnel was full of whispering sound, the echoes of their steps, of their voices, the distant, empty exhale of air moving through the spire's vents and their own breath. Grimm was never sure, after, what tiny hiccup of sound or what flicker of motion in the gloom gave the ambush away. His instincts simply screamed that danger was at hand, and he drew his sword in a liquid whisper of copper-clad steel. Beside him, he felt as much as heard Bayard do the same. And then something, some thing, shrieked in the dark, and a cannonball of howling hot agony hurtled into his chest. Chapter 8 Spire Albion, Habel Morning, Ventilation Tunnels. There was no time to react, and no room to wield even the short, straight blade of his sword. Grimm fell before the horrible, painful weight, and thrust at it with an arm, shoving something that snarled and spit and drew blood with teeth and claws. The creature was perhaps the size of a large child. It flew up and away from him.
Grimm!
I'm fine! Grimm snapped, rolling swiftly to his feet. He tore his jacket from his shoulders and wrapped it swiftly around his left arm.
Cats?
I think not.
No cat ever made a sound like that.
The howling sound repeated itself from either direction of the tunnel.
More than one of them,
Grimm said. Back to back, Bayard replied, and Grimm felt the sudden wiry pressure of the other man's shoulders pressed against the middle of his back.
I shall be friends with taller people,
Grimm panted.
"Bite your tongue, old boy, or I'll hack apart your ankles." There was another motion in the dark, and the creature flew at Grimm again. This time he interposed his leather-wrapped arm and felt claws and teeth sink into it. Grimm let out a shout and spun to his left, slamming the creature against the stone of the spire's wall. He continued the motion of the spin with his right arm, thrusting his short blade home into the thing, and felt the weapon bite sharp and deep. A warbling shriek like nothing he had heard before filled the hallway, even as he heard Bayard cry out, "Ha!" A snarling cry came from somewhere behind Grimm. Grimm had no time to turn to Bayard. The creature was thrashing madly, its claws biting into Grimm's arm, even through the layers of thick leather hide. He struck with the sword as swiftly and viciously as he knew how, praying that he didn't misjudge its length in the dark and impale his own arm. He could see nothing but a vague shape struggling against him, but he could feel hot blood splashing from the wounds his blade inflicted. The thing let out another scream, and then it was abruptly gone. Cries echoed up and down the halls from both directions, fading as they retreated. Grimm instinctively found Bayard again, and made sure his back was against the other man's for the next several moments. They both gasped for breath. Grimm's wounded arm throbbed and burned in a most unpleasant fashion. "Cowards," Bayard panted a moment later, when it was clear that the attack was over. "Bloody cowardly things."
"Indeed," Grimm said. "Shouldn't we be running now?"
"Absolutely," Bayard said. "But half a moment. I've a light here somewhere." Grimm waited impatiently, while Bayard's clothing made rustling sounds. "Ah," he said, "in my waistcoat. I'd almost forgotten." A moment later there was a dim source of pale blue light as Bayard removed a lumen crystal the size of a fingernail from one of his pockets and held it up. The tunnel was unsightly. Blood that looked black in the pale light was splattered everywhere, more near Grimm than Bayard. Bayard himself was scarcely mussed from the action. His sword, though, was stained dark to half the length of its blade.
"God in heaven, you're a sight," Bayard said, lifting an eyebrow. "There's more blood than man."
He looked past Grimm to the heavy splatters on the wall.
"My word, old boy, you missed your calling as a butcher."
"Tried," Grimm said, "but I couldn't manage. I had to settle for the fleet."
"Bitterness does not become you, my friend,"
Bayard said. His dark eyes flicked around the hallway.
"How's your arm?"
"Painful," Grimm said. "I'd as soon not unwrap the coat from around it until we're somewhere where we might find bandages."
"Best we move deliberately, then," Bayard said. "It would be rather funny to watch you run until your heart pumped all your blood out, but I'm afraid Abigail would be cross with me. She might refuse my attentions for hours, even days."
"We can't have that," Grimm said.
He shook as much blood as he could from the blade of his sword, and then grimaced and wiped it off on the leg of his trousers not already soaked with the stuff. He returned the weapon to its sheath just as Bayard finished wiping his sword clean with a kerchief and offered the cloth to Grimm.
"You might have said something,"
Grimm growled. "That outfit's ruined anyway." Grimm glowered at him and opened his mouth to say something more, when Bayard abruptly pitched sideways and began to fall.
"No, that wasn't it at all," Grimm thought.
Bayard was standing perfectly still.
His friend hadn't fallen.
Grimm had.
He could distantly feel the cold spirestone floor beneath his cheek. Bayard's mouth was moving, but the words seemed to be coming at him from several hundred yards down the tunnel, and he couldn't quite make them out. Grimm tried to put a hand beneath him and push himself up, but his limbs wouldn't move.
"Bother,"
Grimm mumbled.
This is rather inconvenient.
Bayard leaned down and peered closely at Grimm's face. The last thing Grimm remembered of the moment was the feeling of being hoisted up onto Bayard's slim, wiry shoulders. Grimm opened his eyes and found himself in a warm, dim room. The ceiling was made of hardened clay, one of the most common construction materials for the more modest residences within Spire Albion. It hadn't been painted white, but instead was covered with a colourful and rather fanciful mural that looked like it had been done by a particularly enthusiastic child. It made little sense, containing seemingly random images of airships, the sun, some sort of odd-looking plants that only partially resembled trees, and an image of the moon that was much too large in relation to the sun opposite it. Strange creatures occupied the same space, none of them familiar to Grimm, though he might have seen some of them in his more fanciful childhood storybooks. The room was lit by dozens and dozens and dozens of tiny, nearly dead lumen crystals, collected in jars of clear glass. Their light was a nebulous thing, showing everything clearly and seemingly originating from nowhere. It was a small, spare chamber, sporting a student's desk and a small and overstuffed bookshelf. He lay on a bed of woven ropes with a thin pad over them, and blankets had been piled over him until they more threatened to smother him than keep him warm. He began to push them away, only to find that his left arm had been bound to his chest. Both arms were wrapped in what seemed to him irrational amounts of cloth bandages. They weren't white. Instead, they had been made from a broad spectrum of every colour and texture of cloth imaginable. One of the strips had little pink heart shapes alternating with bright yellow suns. Grimm sat up, wincing at the pain from his arm. He had a number of other cuts on his upper body, apparently, which were also covered in bandages and some kind of pungent, sterilizing ointment. He didn't remember receiving the minor wounds, but that was hardly unusual in combat. There was a foul taste in his mouth, and his throat burned with thirst. A pitcher and mug on a tray on the bed's nightstand stood ready, and he poured the mug full of water and drank it down three times running before his body began to relent. Someone tapped on the door and then opened it. Grimm looked up to see a young woman enter the room. She was dressed not so much untidily, he decided, as randomly. Her grey shirt was made of ether silk, patched in several places, and looked as though it had been tailored for a man almost 200 pounds heavier than she was. Though the shirt was long enough to serve as a gown itself, she wore a green undergown with rustling skirts that fell to the floor. As she walked toward him, he saw that she wore stockings instead of shoes, green and white polka dots on one foot, and orange and purple stripes on the other. She wore an apron, but it looked to be made of leather, and was burned in several places, a smith's garment rather than kitchenware. Her hair had been dyed in crimson and white stripes, and then braided, so that it resembled a peppermint candy. One lens of her spectacles was pink, the other green, and the band of her too large top hat was fairly bursting with folded pieces of paper. She wore a necklace from which depended a glass vial of nearly spent illumination crystals, and she carried a covered tray in her arms.
"Oh,"
she said, pausing.
"He's awake. Goodness, that was unexpected."
She tilted her head, peering at him first through one lens of her spectacles, and then through the other.
"There, you see? He's fine. He's not mad. Except that he is, and I should know."
She carried the tray to a small table against one wall and whispered,
Should we tell him how improper it is for a gentleman not to wear a shirt when there is a young lady present?
It isn't that we don't appreciate the view, because he's quite masculine, but it does seem like something one should say.
Grimm blinked down at himself and fumbled for the bed covers with one hand, pulling them up.
Please excuse me, young lady, I seem to have lost my shirt.
He thinks I'm a lady, she said, and beamed at him. That's quite unusual in my experience.
Grimm racked his mind for the proper thing to say in such a circumstance, and found little. To be called a lady.
Thinking,
the young woman said.
Now, here is some fresh soup, which doesn't taste very good, but he should eat it all, because the poison thinks it's even worse.
Grimm blinked.
Poison?
The young woman turned toward him and came close enough to lay a hand on his forehead.
Oh, dear. Is he feverish again? No, no. Oh, good. Perhaps he's just simple.
Poor dear.
Before she could turn away, Grimm caught her wrist in his hand. The young woman? No, he decided. The girl's breath seemed to catch in her throat. Her entire body went stiff, and she breathed,
Oh, dear. I hope he doesn't decide to harm me.
He's quite good at doing harm.
It took forever to clean off all the blood.
Child, Grimm said in a low voice, look at me.
She froze abruptly. After a silent second, she said,
Oh, I mustn't.
Look at me, girl,
Grimm said, keeping his voice gentle and calm.
No one is going to hurt you.
The girl flicked a very quick look at him. He saw only a flash of her eyes over the spectacles when she did. One was an even, steady grey. The other was a shade of pale apple green. She shivered and seemed to sag, her wrist going limp in his hand.
Oh,
she breathed.
That's so sad.
Who are you speaking to, child?
He doesn't know I'm talking to you,
the girl said. The fingertips of her free hand rose to the crystals in the little bottle around her neck.
How can he hear me without realizing something so simple?
Ah, Grimm said, and released the girl's wrist very slowly and carefully, as he might a fragile bird's body.
You're an etherealist. Forgive me, child. I didn't realize.
He thinks I'm the master,
the girl said, ducking her head and blushing.
How can he be so clever and so stupid all at once? That must hurt, awfully. But perhaps it would be more polite if we didn't say anything. He seems to mean well, the poor thing, and he's conscious, mobile, and lucid. We should tell the master that it looks like he'll survive.
With that, the girl scurried out of the room, nodding to herself, her soft litany hanging for a moment in her wake. Grimm shook his head. Whoever the girl was, she'd been serving her apprenticeship for a goodly while, despite her apparent youth. All etherealists were odd, and became more so as they aged. Some were a good bit odder than others. The child was at least as strange as any other etherealist he'd met. He went to the tray and uncovered it. There was a bowl of soup and several flatbakes, along with a spoon that would have been modest had it not been made from dark, glossy wood. He tasted the soup, bracing himself for the bitter taste of most medicines, and found it surprisingly bland but pleasant. He fetched out a stool, sat down at the desk, and devoured the soup, along with the flatbakes and two more glasses of water. By the time he finished, he felt almost like a human being. He took note of a plain robe that had apparently been left for him, and managed to tug it on one-handed and belt it at the waist. No sooner had he finished than there was a heavy thump upon the door to his chamber.
"Ow!" said a man's voice. "Damnation to you!"
The latch rattled several times, and the man sighed in a tone of impatience.
"Folly!"
"He doesn't mean to hurt your feelings,"
said the girl, in an apologetic tone. "He's just too brilliant for you." The door opened, and the girl stepped back hurriedly without meeting Grimm's eyes. A man entered the room holding a rumpled handkerchief against his apparently bleeding nose. He was a scrawny specimen, except for a small pot belly, and it made his limbs look out.